Today is Transitions Tuesday on Mind Talk. I am your host, Dr. Pamela Brewer. Mind Talk is the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. And on Transitions Tuesday, we focus on all things related to the many different kinds of transitions we all have occasion to experience in our lives. How often do you hear never give up? Never give up. This is your goal. This is your dream. Never give up. Keep pushing. Keep fighting. You can do it. Well, today's guest has an interesting take on that kind of advice. Tracy Cleantis holds a master's degree in marriage and family counseling, and she has built a national reputation as an expert on healing losses. Tracy Cleantis, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brewer. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, let me ask you about your own never give up story, because you're right. We often hear you can do it, you know, the little engine that could. You keep on trying, you keep on trying, you'll get it done. But you, in fact, begin your book with your own story, with your own never give up story that spanned about 10 years, as I understand.
It did. I like to call myself a professional never give upper. I had a dream. I wanted to have a biological child of my own. And in the pursuit of that, I spent, as you mentioned, about 10 years and over $100,000 trying to do so. I did 4 full rounds of IVF. I did over 20 rounds of artificial insemination. And I didn't stop there. I went way out of my comfort zone, and I did everything that anyone could advise me to do. I did things like hire a feng shui master. I went to a Maori healer. I did vision boards and saw acupuncturists and ate organic food and did affirmations, and I did everything. I was single-mindedly pursuing this goal to the point where it started to bankrupt me emotionally,
sure.
Physically, spiritually, financially, and relationally.
And relationally?
Yes.
How did it impact your relationship?
It became the focus in my marriage. Was the only way that I could imagine being happy in a marriage. It was what we talked about, it's what we planned for. It was literally the center of our lives. And when I finally got to the point of considering that it was too much, I did another round because, you know, people said, well, you're so close, you've invested so much, you can't stop now, you've got to keep going. And I wanted to hear that because I so much wanted a child of my own that I would enter into another round.
Let's talk about, there are lots of people who know all the terminology that you've used, but for those who are listening,
yeah,
who don't understand the terminology just in terms of the pregnancy attempts, I think,
yes,
if they understand what you're talking about, it'll bring home with even more clarity what was going on in your life. IVF, what is that?
IVF is in vitro fertilization, and what that procedure involves is injectable drugs where you're trying to produce a greater number of eggs so that the reproductive endocrinologist can harvest those eggs and inject sperm into those eggs and create embryos that will then be put back into your body. And that procedure is incredibly arduous. It involves me getting up every morning at 7 o'clock before seeing patients and having blood work and ultrasounds and making sure everything was right, and exceptionally expensive. Most insurance plans don't cover this.
Mm-hmm.
So it would range between, depending on the medications, between $20,000 and $40,000 per round.
Per round, and you went through how many rounds?
I did 4 full rounds of in vitro fertilization, and And as I mentioned, over 20 rounds of artificial insemination. Now, that's not as inexpensive as a procedure, but, you know, as emotionally trying, because each time you go through it, there's the hope of this is going to be the time. And with that, occasionally, I would say half the time was with injectable drugs that my husband or I would inject daily on our own to get my body ready to hopefully get pregnant.
So it all sounds like actually physically painful. I mean, with all the injections, with all the drugs you were needing to take, with the strict time guidelines, with the and with artificial insemination, just talk a little bit about what that means.
Artificial insemination involves right time of the month when you're ovulating, the physician would insert sperm and so that it had a better chance of sort of getting to the right place, and they could control the circumstances more closely. And so that also would involve lots of trips to the doctor to prep to make sure that it was the right time, that I was in the right place, that there weren't appropriate eggs and appropriate hormone levels to optimize pregnancy.
And that was just part of what your 10-year journey was like.
That was just part of it. And it's very difficult to fully express how challenging these hormones are. I think the kind of worst archetypes that we have about PMS, if you can take that and kind of blow that up, maybe by 1,000, that's kind of what the experience is of being on infertility drugs.
So clearly what you're describing is not, she did something for 10 years, she tried it a couple of times each year, no big deal, she just kept sort of tooling along. This was a daily, arduous, physically painful, certainly financially painful experience that went on for 10 years. It's almost unimaginable to think about all that you've described, not only that, but just sort of emotionally what was going on for you as you were trying so hard to conceive a child.
Yes, and I think, you know, the really interesting piece of that is that with each round, and there was the sense of I could be pregnant. It was living in a state of constant this could be, and so it modified what I drank. It modified what I ate. It modified a lot of behaviors because I was acting as if I was, because I could have very well been pregnant. So I had to live during that time period as if I was, and kind of physically prepare, and also, you know, being a person who has a psychological background, I was sort of trying to, in some ways, start kind of an attachment process with this imaginal child that I thought could very well be in my belly. So I was emotionally engaging and preparing as well.
And you mentioned your psychological background. I mean, just the fact that you yourself are a therapist or a psychotherapist. So in addition to all of this stuff, you're seeing patients on a regular basis.
Yes. I remember actually after the first round of in vitro, seeing patients the weekend after Mother's Day and finding out that I wasn't pregnant. And it was a day of, I think everyone sort of brought their mother issues in that day.
Sure.
And their family issues. And it was slightly nightmarish. But, you know, fortunately, I was able to somehow really be there and do the work in spite of my own grief.
Which, of course, is what your job is as a therapist. But on the other side of that, you're right. I mean, Mother's Day was holding a really painful, painful, hopeful, painful, hopeful,
yeah.
You know, sort of mindset for you for 10
absolutely.
Years. For
yes.
10 years.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you decided that this was too much.
I did. And you know, Dr. Brewer, when I started this process, I remember the a few days before I began my first treatment, I was fairly nervous. I didn't really understand what the drugs were going to do to my body or how I was going to feel. And I remember taking a walk, and I remember having a sort of inner conversation and making a decision that if at some point this didn't work out, I was going to be okay, and I would stop this. And I don't know where that wise self came from exactly, but I remember clearly that moment. And during the process, as much as I wanted it, and obviously I very much wanted that, and as hard as I was trying, there was something in me that at the end of each round, I would say, you know, is it done yet? Is it soup yet? Are you done?
Yeah.
And obviously for the most part, the answer was no. And then, it just became so, consuming and so exhausting, and resources were draining, emotional resources were draining. And I asked that question after getting the news again that we were not pregnant. I knew that it was time. I knew as much as I had wanted it, there was just a deep knowing in me that this was not going to happen for me.
Okay. 10 years of really pursuing a dream in every conceivable way imaginable. And, you know, as you talk about in your book, you know, when anyone is putting this kind of energy into pursuing a dream, the almost knee-jerk response from people is, don't worry, just keep trying, you're going to get there.
Yes.
And it's said, you know, very often out of a sense of love and wanting to be reassuring. It can also be said out of a sense of, well, you know, really, what else can you say? I mean, are you ever going to really say to somebody who's pursuing a dream, you know, this is really not the dream for you?
No. And I know that if anyone had told me that in the midst of my pursuit, that I would have likely been outraged and offended. And there's no way I could hear that. I think this is very much a decision that you have to come to on your own.
And it is a huge decision.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, I got all kinds of advice about what I should do and how I should keep trying and what changes I should make and if I would, you know, only start to eat organic or if I would only do this or I would see that doctor, if I would read this book, that it would happen for me. And then there was, you know, the kind of advice of, well, maybe you really don't want it. Maybe you're not clear. Maybe you don't have kind of the right intention or your thoughts aren't lined up. And I would get a lot of that kind of advice. And of course, that was always very hurtful.
Absolutely.
To hear that in some way that I didn't want it enough.
Tracy Kleantis, who is the author of The Next Happy. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to move more into how you let go of the life you've planned and find a new way forward. This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk.
Thank you.
Hi, folks. We are back continuing the conversation with Tracy Cleantis. Tracy, we've talked about several of the costs that this kind of never give upness, if you will, can take on an individual. But you also speak in your book about the integrity costs and the spiritual costs. Can you talk about those for a moment?
Absolutely. I've talked to many people about their dreams and their pursuit of their dreams. I really, when I was writing this book, was very clear that not everyone would resonate with my story, and I knew that this was a universal story, that it was not just the pursuit of a child that would create this kind of desire, that everyone has some kind of dream that perhaps didn't work out as they planned. I sort of believe that by the age of 21, you've had some dream that's not worked out as you hoped.
Right.
So I spoke to many people about their dreams, and as I did, I became aware that in the pursuit of dreams, that people began to have a different kind of mindset about the world. It would change their belief about the world, and their kind of personal mottos would change. Their sense of answered prayers or having
yes.
some kind of certainty that if you just wanted enough, that there would be forces for good that would help you achieve this, and people really would move into a kind of despair and mm-hmm. change their sense of the world, the sense of their spiritual life, and that was a cost that I saw over and over for people.
Which makes perfect sense. And for people who, you know, are really turning to their own spiritual beliefs and sense mm-hmm. of self for comfort, if you keep going and going and going, at some point, it's easy to imagine that folks would begin to question their own spiritual beliefs.
Absolutely.
So it really does get to be a very costly endeavor when you adopt this never, ever, 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 no matter what, give
yeah.
up belief system. You,
I really believe that this is a dangerous advice, because it's an advice that's saying don't check in with yourself, that the goal is more important than you are. The goal
mm-hmm.
is so much more and will give you so much more that your health, your finances, your mental health, and your relationships are worth satisfying or are worth sacrificing. And that you'll be so happy if you get this, and that's the only possible way. So you don't dare give up on this.
So you effectively put your entire life on hold in pursuit of this dream.
You do, and I kind of like to talk about it in the book, putting your life on layaway, and that all of your investment and the energy goes on this future orientation where I'm going to be happy when this happens.
Exactly.
And it's an interesting piece of information that I noticed in talking to people, that the time orientation would change for people as mm-hmm. they were in the pursuit of the dream. Their life was very much about future orientation, where when people would let go of the dream, they would move into present orientation. So it's a kind of switch in time zone in terms of pursuing the big dream and then letting go of the dream.
Well, and it's really kind of fascinating. I mean, you know, nowadays every other thing that you hear from folks is about mindfulness, which is a hugely powerful perspective and practice. But that's impossible mm-hmm. to do when you're on this never give up mission.
Absolutely.
You can't be in the moment. You've got to be always geared towards tomorrow. So you're right. I mean, it is putting your life on layaway, and you keep paying literally in lots and lots of ways, and paying and paying and paying and paying.
Absolutely. And I think one of the famous quotes on this came from Lance Armstrong, who famously didn't give up.
Mm-hmm.
That that pain lasts a moment, but quitting lasts forever. And I think that that's kind of part of the mindset of the never give up is, okay, this hurts now, you're in pain now, but it's worth it. It's worth it because in the future, you're going to get this, you're going to have this goal, and it will make all of this pain worthwhile.
You say that positivity is a means, or it can be a means of avoiding reality. And there are lots of folks who really kind of balk at that concept because they see being positive as being positive. I mean, it's a good thing. Yes?
Sure. Well, I think that there's absolutely a time and a place for positivity, but I also like dealing with reality and dealing with what is. And I think that there's a way to bring positivity into reality and into what is and into where you are, and not use positivity as a way to kind of create a narrative of if you just have good thoughts and you just believe and if you just hold on, everything's going to work out for the best.
So don't ignore reality.
Don't ignore reality.
Don't use it as a way to ignore what's real.
That's right.
At the point that you were able to make the decision that this was enough for you, mm-hmm. that you were done, and anyone else who is living in the space of tomorrow, which is what this is really all about in a lot of ways, and then they decide they're going to live in the space of today, there are stages of shame and blame and grief and everything else that you go through. What was that time like for you?
Well, it's a really, you know, it's such a complicated process when you finally have the courage to what I call name the time of death on a dream. Mm. It doesn't happen all at once. It's not just okay, I'm done, and then I'm done. If it was only so. But it's much more about perhaps first there's a kind of motivational death. I no longer have the motivation. I no longer have the energy to invest in that goal. And at that point, you may still be engaging in kind of behaviors, but there may not be the motivation. And the sort of next stage would be for there to be a kind of behavioral death. You're no longer acting in a way that's pursuing that goal. Now, even if you no longer have motivation or the behavior, you can still have obviously the emotional energy and the cognitive aspects of the dream still be alive.
Right.
So, going through those stages when each of these different aspects of a pursuit of a goal are still alive, that there's some elements that are still alive. It's very, very, very difficult because you're conflicted. You don't have the motivation. You may not be acting on it, but there's the emotion. There's the thoughts. And for this process to happen, I wish there was a kind of fixed and definite timeline of how long it would take, but there's not. And I don't think that people know this. And I think instead what they sort of feel like is, okay, if I'm making the decision to be done, I should be done, and I should just move on. And very often feel I should quickly set up the next goal. I should immediately move into some other pursuit to lessen the pain.
And also, I would think the shame of pursuing this goal for such a long period of time, because when we say, you know, the never give up person, we're not talking about the person who has a goal on Monday and gives it up on Friday. We're talking about the person who's actually throwing their whole lives into whatever this goal is. And then when they decide to back away, I would think there'd be a lot of shame.
Absolutely.
And what do you do with that?
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, I see this a lot in young people. Who haven't spent so much time in the pursuit of the goal. But, you know, maybe for 3 years they thought they were going to go to this college, or they imagined getting the scholarship, or they imagined a certain job upon graduation. And this, you know, I remember when I was first talking about this book, I was told by a publisher, they said, well, this is a book for people in midlife. And I don't really think that's true. I think that this is something that happens in every stage of life, that we all have goals and dreams that we may not spend years on, but still have a lot of an emotional investment.
Exactly.
And when they don't work out, even though we've worked very, very hard to make that happen, there is shame. There is some sense of, I should have made this work, that I didn't make it work. There's something wrong with me. And people want to hide that and repress that. And so very often, there's a kind of sour grape psychology that kind of happens. Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't really want that anyway. I'm just going to move on to the next thing. And this is where I think, you know, that kind of positivity can be dangerous, because saying that positivity needs to happen here will sometimes lead to repression of that shame.
Okay.
And pushing that down and saying, you know, I'm so uncomfortable with these shameful feelings of feeling like it's my fault that it didn't work out. But they don't bring those feelings to the surface, and they move on too quickly and pretend that they didn't care when they really did.
When they cared a great deal.
Absolutely.
And then, of course, there are the folks around who will say things like, isn't it a shame that after all of this work that you put into this thing, you had to give this up? I can't think of a more painful but a more natural thing that you would hear from some people around you.
Mm-hmm. And I think that kind of reaction, it can be very empathic and can be helpful for people to understand how difficult that is, and to have sensitivity to, this is very difficult. And I guess what I would hope is that there would be a kind of more room for that in the culture, to say, this is really hard and this is something we've all gone through, as opposed to telling people, keep at it, you shouldn't give up. I'm approaching 50 this month, and people still want to tell me what I could do to have a baby, still want to give me advice. And it's very hard for people to hear that your dream didn't come true. And I've always kind of had a theory that it's about, on some level, yes, of course, people care about me and mm-hmm. care about people in their life, but they also don't want to believe that perhaps their dreams won't come true, that perhaps everything in their vision will not come to fruition.
I think that's very much a part of it. And as you said, often on quite an unconscious level. Folks, we are talking to Tracy Cleantis, the next happy, let go of the life you planned and find a new way forward with joy, I might add. That's where we're going to start when we come back from this break. We are back, and let's talk about the way to move on to the next happy? What are some of, let's say that you have gone through the process of putting that, recognizing that that goal, that dream is something that doesn't serve you in the way that perhaps it did when you began, and that you're going to do something different. Are there some first steps that you might take right after you finish reading the next happy?
Well, I in the book, I really wanted to create a roadmap of your, you have a dream that has, it hasn't worked out, to help you stage by stage move through how to get to the next happy. And the reason, Dr. Brewer, that I wanted to do this, there were so many books when I was in pursuit, of having, of following my dream. Mm-hmm. And when it was time to give up and let go and move on, I didn't find much in terms of support. And there was nothing in the bookstores. And I went online, I looked for blogs, I looked for anywhere to give me support on how do I move from this process of grief to happiness. And at that point, actually, I was just hoping for someone to help me get through the grief. I didn't even imagine happiness was a possibility.
Of course. Just get through the day. Just get through the day.
Exactly. And I literally found nothing. Mm-hmm. So I had to kind of invent my own way and find my own guide in this. And one of the first things I started to do was to write about this experience on my blog and started to develop community. And in that, I started to do speaking on how to be happy without the hope of having a biological child. And I would see people who were in the midst of pursuing the dream, who wanted promise that they too could be happy, even if it didn't work out for them. Mm. And I realized that this was a universal experience. And as I was speaking on this, I became really aware that I knew I had found that road from disappointment, disillusionment, how to get through the grief, and how to get to the next happy. And I didn't really know it until I started to teach it, which is often the way. And I think I've touched on this before, is I really believe that the grief is such an important piece in getting to your next happy. Yeah. And I think that that's not something people usually think about when they think about happiness. But I really believe that unless you grieve this dream that was so important to you, that you're not going to get to that next happy. So that the grief piece is so important and also so difficult.
Indeed. And it's so important, I would think, to find supports that are actually supportive as you're going through this process.
Absolutely. Like we touched on, there are many people who want to give us the advice to continue to keep at it. And when you're grieving that's not the kind of support you need. And so I write in the book about it's very important to kind of vet your support team. Who are you sharing what with? What kind of support can you get from different people in your life? Who can really be there for you as you're going through the grief process? It's a difficult thing for people in our lives to see us suffering. So I do encourage people to turn to group support, to turn to other people who've gone through similar losses, to go to therapy as a way to just have a place where you can just talk about this and grieve this and not need to take care of anyone else's feelings.
Speaking of other people, you had somebody who was on the never give up path with you.
I did.
You had a partner who was very much engaged as you were. And I wonder if we don't sometimes forget, just as a people forget, that there is often a significant other who's going through whatever the issue is, whether it's a dream met or a dream deferred, a dream absolved. I mean, I think that's another important piece.
Absolutely. And I think very often partners can be at different places with goal disengagement or letting go of the dream. And that can make things more difficult if one partner is still engaged in the dream and one isn't. And so it's a very individual and personal process of letting go of the dream and can certainly add to the pain and the difficulty to be in a different place than your partner as you're going through this. But I wanted to just briefly kind of touch on one of your questions that you asked.
Okay.
Another piece after the grief is processed, I really encourage people in their work to kind of analyze their dream. I come from a background, I've done a lot of training in Jungian psychology and psychoanalytic psychology. And in my private practice, I work with dreams, nighttime dreams. But in the book, I talk about analyzing the dream, the goal, the vision for the life you plan, as if it was a dream.
As if it was a dream. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, we talk about these things as dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's a sort of meaning to that. And in nighttime dreams, it's very common. We sort of all know that people bring dreams to therapy and you analyze them and you try to kind of find out the meaning. And there's dictionaries that tell you what your dreams mean.
Right.
But your daytime dreams, your visions for your life, your goals, your desires, we don't tend to analyze those and try to kind of deconstruct what's the meaning. Why do I want this so much?
Yes.
And I in the book talk about taking that dream, that goal, that vision, and really working with it symbolically to find out what you thought the dream was going to give you and what it meant in your life. Why was that dream so purposeful? And everyone I've talked to about their waking dream, mm-hmm. their goal, their vision, there's always been something underneath it.
Yes.
If I get this, I'll be loved. If I get this, I'll be safe. If I get this, my father will love me. There's always a if-then-when
uh-huh.
to the dream.
And that's,
and so I think it's really important in
yes.
terms of getting to the next happy to really understand what is it you wanted. And if you're wanting love by getting the big job, there's no guarantee that that job is actually going to give you love.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to give you a job.
Right.
Winning an Academy Award, which many people do tonight, people have dreams and visions of what will happen when they get that statue in their hands. It isn't necessarily going to happen. But if we get clear on, I want this to give me a specific feeling, I want to have this emotional experience, we can sort of pull apart and say, is it possible? Is it likely? And if I have to get into medical school to get love and appreciation for my family, how is that going to feel?
Right.
So even if we were to realize that dream and we find out that we're hoping that it's going to give us these kind of emotional experiences, getting them might not exactly feel as we imagined they would.
And I would think that with that kind of analysis, which would be really critical on so many levels, it can, I would think, help to reduce some of that negative self-talk that goes on when you make the choice to let the dream go and perhaps open you up to something that might really meet what was under the goals that were underneath your stated dream.
Absolutely. I remember at one point I was doing a lot of heavy grieving with my analyst, and you know, sitting on his couch and him asking me this question, well, why did you want it so much? And it was, at the time it seemed such a crazy question to me,
mm-hmm.
and self-evident, and not worth engaging with, but then I started to really think about this. Why did I want this so much, and what did I think it would give me? And I think there's just the simple truth that I wanted children, and that there's a kind of evolutionary pull in all of us humans to procreate. There was a multitude of reasons, but there was a very personal reason that I think was driving me so significantly, is that I wanted to give a child a kind of life that I didn't have as a mm-hmm. child. That there was a kind of fantasy that this was going to be a corrective experience by offering this to a child.
And
in knowing that, I was able to, once I really accepted it, to start to give that kind of corrective experience to myself.
Wonderful. Which, and in doing that, it gives you more power, gives you more energy. It can be just so incredibly affirming and restorative.
Absolutely. It was very interesting in interviewing these people for the book, as I'm having conversations about their dreams. Very often through the questions I have in the book, at the end of each chapter, I have questions to kind of engage you in your own process. And I asked these questions of people I interviewed, and they would come to, oh gosh, this, I didn't really realize that I wanted to be a talk show host so that my father would finally listen to me. I didn't realize that I wanted this home, this dream home, so much because I imagined that if I had it, there would be a lot of friends and family who came over, and there would be all of these good, loving family feelings. And it's great to be a talk show host. I'm sure you'd agree. And it's fantastic to have a lovely home, but there's no guarantee that that means your dad's finally going to listen to you.
Exactly.
Or that when you get the house, that everybody's going to show up and it's going to feel like the Brady Bunch.
So as you are going through this process, and I can even imagine folks going through your book, and at some point there are going to be at least a few people who are going to think, you know, I might need more help than this. How do you know when therapy or some other tool is an appropriate thing for you to access, that you're in a place where additional help would make a lot of sense?
I think first off, if you're feeling depression or any kind of suicidal ideation, obviously, I would advise you to immediately seek therapy.
So any thoughts of self-harm?
Any
thoughts of self-harm. Okay.
And I would say, if you feel like in any way you're kind of editing yourself, or you're being positive, or you're trying to put a good spin on things, and you're trying to have a good attitude about it, and you're kind of minimizing your feelings, and you don't want people to know how you're feeling, or you're kind of socially isolating and keeping distance from people because you're feelings that you're not comfortable sharing with people, I think that's a really good indicator that it's time to get some support where you just get to speak your truth absolutely and share your feelings without editing.
Gotcha. Folks, you are listening to Tracy Kleantis, the author of The Next Happy. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, Tracy, I'd like to pick up with this notion that many people have this fear that if you feel your feelings, the world is going to end, something really bad is going to happen. So we'll pick up with that, because that I think is what keeps a lot of people from really allowing themselves to feel their feelings. Folks, my name is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Do not go away. We will be right back. Tracy, the idea that many people have that the fear, for some the terror, that if they let themselves feel their feelings, something really bad is going to happen. Can you talk about that fear for a moment?
Absolutely. I think we're given so many messages from such an early age. Big boys don't cry. If you can't put a smile on your face, go into your room until you can find something to smile about.
Right.
We're given a message over and over that feelings are not okay. That our feelings make other people uncomfortable. That if we feel something, we're going to feel it forever. And I like in my psychotherapy work to equate feelings to weather. You know, if it's 70, I'm in sunny Southern California, and if I look outside and I see that it's drizzling this morning, I don't say to myself, well, it's raining, so it's going to rain forever.
Mm-hmm.
I notice the rain, I notice the sadness, I deal with it. I don't deny it. I don't put on a bathing suit and say, well, it's gonna be sunny if I just think positively. And deny the fact that there's rain or sadness. I deal with what is and know that this is a transitional state and not one that I'm going to be in forever.
That's so freeing. I mean, that's such an important way to look at the fact of feelings, that they're not going to remain the same for always.
That's right. And they're trying to tell us something. And I think really, you know, the research shows that just to say out loud the words, I'm sad, if you're sad, while in an MRI, it shows that your brain starts to becomes more engaged and the frontal cortex starts to become involved. And you're not just a kind of an amygdala feeling. And the non-clinical way to break that down is to say you are more resourceful. You are more able to engage in the present. You are more able to be mindful. You're more able to likely move into happiness by saying, I'm sad, than you are to repress it. Because if you repress it, then the weather turns into something else. Then the weather is stuck in us and doesn't go anywhere. And we're not allowing it to kind of flow through us.
So the overarching, I think, message in your book is that there is life after the never give up disease.
Yes.
Because it does create so much dis-ease. It can create so much dis-ease in people. And you're saying there is a life after that. And there's a life that can actually be freeing and full and sort of resounding in a way that it wasn't when you were so connected to this dream that meant more to you than perhaps you realized.
I think it can be so consuming, that dream, and so future oriented that you don't get to live in the present. And I just see over and over that when people let go of the dream and move into present time orientation and have grieved it and have pulled out the meaning of why did I want this so much and really get to that, and not rush into something else that's just about pushing the pain away or trying to fill that emptiness, that without fail something emerges, and it emerges in a different way. It doesn't have the kind of pressure that the dream, whatever interest or desire or experience starts to happen, it doesn't have the same kind of I have to have this or I'm not going to be happy. My life doesn't depend on this one thing. It can really be an opportunity to disengage from that kind of thinking about goals and dreams and visions. I like to say that dreams go from big D dreams, capital letter D, to little d dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And you would imagine that little d dreams are not as satisfying, but I'd say they're more satisfying because they allow us to have other dreams and other interests and have our orientation be in the now as opposed to waiting for some future day where happily ever after happens and everything is perfect. And that day sadly never comes for any of us.
And it also sounds like those little d dreams are much more, they're healthier.
Absolutely. Yeah.
One of the points that you make is that you need to plan what you say to the never give up people. That makes so much sense when you think about it, but I'm not sure people would really think about that.
Yes, I think that kind of preparing yourself, I kind of like to encourage people to kind of create a script of how they're going to talk about their dream or their disengagement from the dream and their process with those people to protect themselves from the kind of assault of feeling like they're wrong to let go of the dream, that they need to get back into the never giving up.
Right.
So really kind of thoughtfully having a script of what you share and who you share it with.
Good point. What you share and who you share it with. Because there are some folks who, perhaps from a place of shame, will feel the need to tell everybody everything as a way to justify their decision, which maybe doesn't need to be justified.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that people have to sort of earn the right to hear our most vulnerable truth. That's something Brené Brown talks about. And not everyone needs to know about this process and needs to know about our grief and needs to know about this decision. We get to be selective and careful who we share this with.
Is it okay to say to folks that you don't want to go into a lot of detail with that you've come to a different place and you'd rather not talk about it, or is there something else that would be better served in shutting down the nosies, if you will?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I first was moving into Never Give Up around having a child, I used a kind of a lot of euphemisms. I would say things like, when people would ask if I have children, it's something people ask every day. I would say things like, I wasn't blessed. We weren't lucky. Those kind of things, they felt self-protective. And over time, as I moved through my grief, I'm now absolutely comfortable saying I had infertility. So in those early stages, that wasn't appropriate for me.
Okay.
But now that I've worked through that grief, there's no pain, there's no anxiety. I'm not at all concerned about how people are going to respond to that. And if people want to start telling me what I should have done or asking what I did, kind of proving that it's okay to give up, I won't engage with that. And I'm very comfortable saying, you know, I did as much as I'm comfortable doing, and I feel good about how much I invested in that dream.
And that could very reasonably end the that conversation with that person who you don't really want to engage in a dialogue with anyway, not around that
Absolutely.
Issue.
Absolutely.
One of the recommendations that you make is the movie The Silver Lining. Can you very briefly tell us why that seems like such an important film for you?
Well, I wanted to use films to kind of bring that point home for every chapter. And I used Silver Linings Playbook for the first chapter to talk about, I don't know if everyone's seen that film, but it's a wonderful film about a man who's lost his marriage, and he's absolutely distraught and devastated and has a violent response to it, to seeing his wife with another woman or another man. He develops a plan of, I'm going to get her back. And I want people to kind of see that the consequences and the costs and how in this film he has so many opportunities in his present that he isn't able to see or isn't able to take advantage of because he's so focused on this dream and imagining what that dream is going to give him. So I think that films can offer us wonderful cinema therapy as we're going through this process of letting go what didn't work for us and moving on into our next happy.
Absolutely. Tracy Cleant is author of The Next Happy. You have a blog, I believe. Can you give us that blog address before we run out of here?
Absolutely. I hope you come visit me at www.tracycleantis.com.
All right, and that is TracyCleantis.
Yes.
Okay. Tracy, thank you again so much. Tracy Cleant is author of The Next Happy, Let Go of the Life You Plan, and Find a New Way to Move Forward. Thank you very much, Tracy.
Thank you so much, Dr. Brewer.
Folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Remember, you can also listen to Mind Talk on demand anytime you like at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service and is not intended to replace the treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. And remember, for more information, you can always go to mindtalk.org. Again, that's mindtalk.org. And remember, too, if it's unacceptable, that's exactly, precisely, resoundingly what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.